I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Julia Butterfly Hill, is principled. She's the starting point this hour for a conversation about how far you would go, Connection listeners, for what you believe. She lived in a redwood tree, 180 feet high, 1,000 years old, for 2 years. In fact, it was 738 days. It was supposed to be a 2 or 3 week tree sit-in, a protest to stop Pacific Lumber from clear-cutting this tree and those around it. But that wasn't enough time to save the tree or to make her point, so she stayed. She survived severe rainstorms, life-threatening harassment, broken toes, frostbite, maddening hunger, and absolute loneliness, all for the principle of the thing. What about you, Connection listeners? Have you ever taken a stand for something you deeply care about? Have you ever sacrificed money, or love, or sleep, or food, your job maybe, for your convictions? The phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK to make the principal connection with Julia Butterfly Hill. Joining us later in the hour will be Granny D, who in her 80s hiked across this country in pursuit of campaign finance reform. Also, Jeffrey Wigand, the former tobacco executive who blew the whistle on the cigarette industry and all the secrets that they were keeping from smokers to keep them hooked. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone. Julia Butterfly Hill, welcome back from up that tree. I just wonder, were you looking for a dramatic confrontation, or did this thrust itself upon you?
No, I was not looking for confrontation, that's for sure. I was looking for purpose in my life. I, for many years of my life, was leading my life the way society tells us we're supposed to, that our value as human beings is based pretty much solely on how much money do we make and spend. And if we're not a part of an economic system, we're valueless. This is why we see mothers being forced into work instead of placing value on them staying at home with their children and instilling in them a sense of self-worth and values and morals. This is why we're seeing 97% of our original ancient redwoods cut down, and yet this 3% remaining that's left still being allowed to be cut down. And a car wreck in August of 1996 awakened me to the fact that I had a purpose in life separate from making and spending money. We've been around since before money. We have been given a gift of life. There's a purpose for us more than just what man has said for us. So I went in search of that purpose. And I wasn't searching for activism. I was just searching for, why am I here? Why am I alive? And when I entered the ancient redwoods for the first time, I fell in love. The beauty, the power, the magnificence, the spirituality of these forests takes one's breath away. And a few weeks later, I saw a picture at the Environmental Protection Information Center that looked like a bomb had been dropped in the middle of the forest. And I said, what in the world is that? And I said, that's how Pacific Lumber Maxam Corporation does business. And it ripped my gut out, it ripped my heart out, and I reached a point where I had to do something. I couldn't turn and walk away. I had this calling that said, Julia, you must do something. And that was the beginning of what turned into a 2-year tree sit.
Did you have to do it, or did you have time to calculate what you were sacrificing here?
I actually climbed up for the first time in November. I stayed for 6 days. I went down on the ground for 1 day. I came back up for 5 days, and I went down on the ground for 3 weeks because I hadn't given water that was contaminated, and it made me very sick. And during that time, I had decided that tree sitting was not enough for me. A typical tree sit only lasts a few days to a week because it is a very grueling, intense experience, and it's very hard on the body. And now, it's important for listeners to know that tree sitting has been going on many, many, many years. In Humboldt County, where I was, it had been going on for nearly 15 years before I got there. And tree sitting is a way to bring a spotlight to the point where a forest becomes a product and show people what's happening to the forest, what's happening to the planet, what's happening to people's lives as a result. And usually if you see someone putting their body on the line, it's because everything else has failed. The government is failing in its responsibility to the citizens. The corporations are failing in their responsibility to the people and to the planet. And consumers are failing in their responsibility to educate themselves and to be conscious of what we do, what we buy, what we throw away. And I felt, well, this is an important action. It is important to do tree sitting, but it's not enough for me. But then the tree sit came under attack. The loggers were moving in to the timber harvest plant area, that is the logging operation, where the tree was, and there was no one left to sit. So I said, well, I'll go up for 3 weeks to a month. And that was December 10th, 1999. And 738 days later, I came down. But during that 3 weeks to a month process is when I realized that we really needed to do something more. The forests are truly in critical condition, and not only the ancient redwoods, but forests worldwide. We've lost half of the planet's original forest, half of them, and we are cutting them down at nearly 32 million acres per year around the world. That's, for listeners to get an idea, that's the size of Poland every year of forest that's disappearing. And I thought, okay, the only way to help people understand how critical this truly is if I put my life in as critical of condition with it as I know how.
Julia Butterfly Hill has been called the Joan of Arc of the Redwoods. Her book is called The Legacy of Luna. Luna was the name she gave the tree she lived in for 2 years. But she really raises the question on which we want a connection jury's answer. What would you do for a cause? What's a worthy cause? How far would you go? What kind of sacrifice would you make? Or do we even calculate these things as sacrifice? Do we know where to draw the line between sort of acting out and acting for principle? What have you done? Connection listeners, what would you do to make a point? 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. They called you Joan of Arc afterward. Who were your models and who were your heroes? What did you think you were doing?
I was raised with a traveling preacher for a father, so my whole life was in church, and all I knew was church and God. And so I really didn't have heroes. But since coming down, since going into the tree sit, and then throughout this time, and even still as I've come down, for me, the hero is in the small things. That just because a spotlight on me has come to me doesn't really make me any different than anyone else. It's made my life a lot different. It's like walking around with a microscope and a magnifying glass following me everywhere I go. But people relate to me because there's an international spotlight on me. But what I try and help people understand is that the hero lies within each and every one of us. It is our everyday choices. My heroes now are the people finding shelter for the homeless, giving them blankets, finding them food, standing in the way when a child is being abused, standing up for animal rights, standing up for the species on this planet today and future generations whose voices are not being heard. And the one thing that's important to me is that labels and stereotypes are really disconnecting in our world. And so when we say something like an activist, it makes some of us all think that an activist is someone different than us. But if you think about an activist, it means taking action. And every one of us take action every single day. So for me, part of the message is the personal responsibility in our daily lives. What are we buying? What are we throwing away? I reach out and say, look, I bring a reusable mug with me everywhere I go so that I don't have to buy a paper cup that then gets thrown away. We are consuming 14 generations worth in a single generation in today's society, and much of it we're throwing away. It's like we're stealing from the future and then throwing it away. So I try and reach out to people, and I hope that callers call in and recognize that to take a principled stand first has to start in your daily life, that's what's going to make the world a better place, ultimately.
People joke about tree huggers, though. They don't quite believe, I think, in the little itty-bitty conservation gestures. They're looking, a lot of us, I suppose, for much grander gestures like yours. Where do you see people doing things comparable to what you did? 2 years in a tree, after all. And you still got to explain to us how that's possible. What you ate, for example. How you slept.
Well, I absolutely will. I just want to make a clarified point here that little bitty gestures aren't that little bitty. That, yes, it is important that we take a stand. Our life as we know it, the health of our planet, the health of our future, the health of us today is threatened. And so we have to be willing to take a principled stand. We must be willing to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do despite the risk. But at the same time, the little bitty things aren't that little bitty. When I'm walking around in my daily life now on the ground, I see 200 and 300 people carrying around paper cups. If everyone would do those little itty bitty things, it would be huge. It's those small things day by day that going numb in our consciousness that has led us to a point where a woman has to live in a tree for 2 years to protect it. So I just want to help people understand that yes, the principled stands and the big stands are vital, but the small things aren't that small, and we really have to include those too.
Connection listeners, we're talking about small gestures, and even better, big ones that require you to take a very, very deep breath and put a lot on the line. What have you done? What do you want to do? What can Julia Butterfly Hill prompt you to do? She lived in a tree for 2 years, 2 years and 8 days, to save a redwood forest. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Doris Haddock, who's 89 years old, is on the line. Doris Haddock, a.k.a. Granny D. In pursuit of campaign finance reform, she spent 14 months walking across the United States. Doris Haddock, welcome. What was the principle here?
Are you talking to me now?
We are indeed.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us.
The idea was to try to get a bill passed, the McCain-Feingold bill, to get rid of the soft money in order to get our country back to where it belongs, a country of and by and for the people, not a country in which the elections are run by the rich people in this country.
It's a long walk for clean politics.
Well,
did it work better for you than it did for John McCain?
I don't know. I think if John McCain had stayed with it instead of getting negative, he would have been better off. Of course, I'm not political, so I really couldn't tell you that, but that's the way it looked to me.
What prompted you to do it?
What?
I say, what prompted you to do it? And how did you sort of get off the high board and say, by gum, I'm going to walk across this country?
Because I became very angry with what was going on. I have 12 great-grandchildren, and I didn't want them and all the boys and girls in this country to grow up to have to sell their souls if they wanted to run for office or be a very wealthy man. And that is not a democracy. And too many people have given up their lives for the democracy for us to let it go down the drain.
Granny D, this is Julia Butterfly Hill, and I just wanted to thank you for what you've done and what you're continuing to do, because one of the things that I saw was how much our society has placed value on money above everything else. And I'm so thankful to you for taking that stand and teaching us and reminding us about the importance that it is the human beings who have the power, and it is the human beings who make the change, and that we shouldn't have to run our lives by who has the most money, because when these people in office are elected to represent the people, and then they have this much money, they end up being answerable to the money above the people and above the nature that we share. So thank you.
Granny D, I want to thank you too, but I want you to explain, what kind of a walk was it? How did it go?
Well, I started in Pasadena, mm-hmm. and went south all along Arizona, New Mexico, 4 months in Texas, then started up turned the corner and went up through Tennessee and Kentucky and Ohio and so forth.
A lot of blisters, I would think.
I'm sorry?
I say it sounds like a lot of blisters.
No, there were no blisters. There were lots of pains and aches, but you walked through them.
Well, I'm tickled to hear your example on our program, Granny D. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Christopher. I've watched you for many, many years.
Well, bless you. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about issues that would prompt you to do an extreme thing, Connection listeners, to make a point, to declare what you think is important. Our guest in the studio, Julia Butterfly Hill, lived in a tree for 2 years to save it. 1-800-423-TALK. Mike is calling from Mississippi.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
I'm not so sure that this is worthy, but I do feel a great deal of empathy and feeling for a certain group of unsung people, I think. In our state in 1970, there was a forced desegregation of the public schools. And at that time, there were quite a few white Caucasian people who stuck with the public schools because of principle and believed in the principles of equality for all people and forming a better society here in our state because of through public education and through making the public schools work for everyone. And these people sacrificed a great deal at that time, and they're very unsung. In the civil rights movement, there's very little said about the white mothers and fathers who kept their children in school under a great deal of pressure from their peers who pulled away and went to private academies, segregation academies, white teachers who, and this is from a personal experience because I was a teacher, and whose homes were windows were knocked out in their homes, whose tires were cut on their cars, a lot of things, ostracized by people with whom they had played bridge for scores of years, churches that were split up, congregations and churches that were split up because of this. And there's been very little said about that, and I just kind of wanted to applaud these people. And if you ever come to Mississippi, if you've been to Mississippi, it's not what people purport it to be, simply, I think, because of these people.
Mike, a point well made. What is the reward or the burden on those people 30 years later, would you say?
Well, I think they can, because of the way that the school systems have turned out, we have in many, many areas, we have very progressive school boards and school systems, and the rewards are that the people who have done this and made those great sacrifices can look back and with a great deal of pride, and albeit personal pride. You know, there's not going to be somebody come up and pat them on the shoulder and say, we thank you for what you did then. It has to be something within themselves.
Mike, thank you. Thank you for your example, and thank you for calling The Connection. 1-800-423-8255. What would you do for principle, Connection? What have you done for principle? Who have you seen do something for principle, a really far-out act, and be vindicated? 1-800-423-TALK. Nelson is on the line.
Yes, I was in World War II, and you could say that was something for principle. I'm 75 years old. And to get rid of Hitler and the Japanese was well worthwhile.
Where did you fight, Nelson?
I was in the Pacific, flying in B-29s over Japan part of the time. Nothing very dangerous, but a few combat missions and so forth. And I think speak for the veterans, that's why I called.
Well, let's hear it for the veterans.
Sure. I think that my views personally are very radical on what would solve the world's problems.
Give us an idea.
Well, I don't quite know how to put it, except that if Alexander the Great were to have come and spoken to us when we were fighting the Gulf War, he might have said, well, why don't you go for it? And we would say, what do you mean? And of course, he would mean that perhaps the world would be better off with one ruler or one society, and we could forget about these religious problems and so forth and get off with colonizing Mars and whatnot. Otherwise, this is all sort of trivia, these ethnic differences and these religious differences.
Nelson, you're a man of courage and imagination, too. 1-800-423-8255. The question, Connection listeners, is how far would you go for principle? And how would you make it dramatic? What danger, what sacrifice to yourself would you undertake to make a really important point? BJ is on the line.
Hi, Judy.
Hello, BJ.
Hey, thank you. Best program. Judy, I spent some time up on the West Coast, not quite as dramatic, but nonetheless, I was living in Southwest Oregon in the early 90s, and the call came through the grassroots phone lines about the so-called Thanksgiving Day Massacre, where up in Owl Creek, up there in Humboldt County, the Pacific Lumber Company had gone in illegally without the proper environmental statements and whatnot to start cutting down on the weekend when there was nobody around. It was a very sneaky thing. So suddenly I just felt like, you know, they're asking around, you know, who's going to go down, who's going to go down. And I just said, this is it. I've got to go. So I had never been down through that stuff before. And so I went down and traveled with somebody I didn't know hundreds of miles through the night and got after midnight into a camp in the redwoods. Didn't know where I was. There were little campfires and people huddled around. And then before dawn, I'm in the back of a pickup truck bouncing up logging road with another pickup truck behind us. And then just as dawn's light was coming up, we were heading down through the woods, through these incredible, immense cathedrals of trees. And then we're hearing the diesel engine starting up through the trees and the adrenaline and, you know, trying to strategize how are we going to play cat and mouse. And it was a, you know, a nonviolent direct action trespassing in order to slow down the illegal logging while the lawyers on the legal end were trying to get an injunction. And later that day, they did get an injunction. But meanwhile, the trees started falling. I'll never forget the feeling of those trees, the shockwave coming through the ground. It was just horrifying. And we eventually got surrounded and chased, and I ran like a jackrabbit with a wolf on my tail, and I've never experienced such adrenaline. And I had a backpack on, and I just couldn't keep up, and I fell down into a gully full of slash and got all cut up. And then the guy pounced on me, and I immediately went into nonviolence mode, and just like I was in such tune with this guy who's on top of me, this big burly logger with a white helmet on, and he actually walked me over. He didn't harm me or anything because I was just completely nonviolent and actually trying to joke with him and everything. But he walked me down the tree that we had tried to stop them from cutting. They had felled it in the meantime.
BJ, catch your breath. You're listening to The Connection. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about grand gestures to make a principled point. Could I just ask you, BJ, what did you take to be the risk of loss, danger, life, limb, fortune, freedom in this caper?
Could you repeat the question?
Well, I mean, what did you calculate to yourself or in your heart as the downside here?
Well, the downside is losing something that is absolutely priceless and ineffable. There's a mystical spiritual quality to untouched, unmarred life, ecosystems that transcend our civilization. This is
so. I know, but I'm thinking of the downside to you. I mean, did you ever worry you'd get killed?
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, it was all just adrenaline, but it was out of complete empathy with what is going on there. I mean, these trees, this ecosystem is being killed. Absolutely.
BJ, this is Julia. I was just wondering if, like, I know from personal experience, I didn't sit down on the ground and calculate the risks and the possible outcomes. I just knew that something had to be done. It was something deep inside of me that called me into action and said, Julia, you had to put your body on the line because there's a point in time where something that's irreplaceable and priceless is being destroyed. And if your body can make a difference, then you've got to be willing to give that. And I know that's how it was for me. And only as I started going through the intensities where I started going, oh, my God, this is so intense. But at the same time of feeling that, I was also feeling a sense of strength that I was doing the right thing, and that helped keep me going. How about for you?
Yes, it was just a non-rational instinct pulling me there. That's all I can say. I mean, there's no intellectual calculation about it. It is just purely being open to what is real and what's most important, and that's on a feeling level, not on a calculation of worth.
BJ, could I ask? I mean, were you looking for those People magazine cameras? Did you want to write a book too, or not?
No, not at all. I've hardly anybody knows this about me. I keep it to myself, to tell you the truth, and I'm almost kind of ashamed about that. But
now, what's your day job now?
I've been landscaping. So.
Well, that figures.
Yeah.
BJ, thank you.
Thank you.
And more power to you.
You know, I'd like to say real quickly just that I certainly wasn't looking for the cameras either. the purpose of going out into the forest and doing things like tree sits, though, is to help make the world aware of what's happening. The first step in making change is making people aware. And most, as you know, I'm sure, and many people in media know, media oftentimes has to compete with entertainment industry so much that they want a hook, they want an angle. That's why I'm in the studio today. And so that's not set out of disrespect. It's set out of an understanding of where our society is. And to me, the spotlight, the press and everything else is something else I gave up. My privacy, my everything in my life, I gave up in an effort to make people aware and try and inspire others to take a stand.
How did it touch the inner Julia, the secret you, the completely private you? Was there a, I mean, was it sounds like a transformative experience.
Yes. Well, I was living my life so much the way society tells us you're supposed to. I graduated high school at a very early age, went straight into college, majored in business, started my first business when I was 18 years old, was really doing societal accepted norms. Then I went on search for something more. And then I saw something happening that said, I have to act. And I was so naive.
How many people told you you're crazy?
Oh, well, they still do. But what I think is crazy is that 97% of the ancient redwoods are cut down and they're still cutting them down, that they're spraying toxic diesel fuel and herbicide, that they're clear cutting, that they're cutting on steep hillsides that are destroying fisheries and people's lives and homes like the residents in Stafford below. That's crazy. And so I think that's why you see someone putting themselves in a crazy position. Mm. You don't put your body on the line because it's a fun thing to do. You put your body on the line because it's the last line of defense. It is the last possible
connection
hope.
Listeners, for what would you put your body on the line? That's the question. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the What Would You Do for Principle connection. Our guest, Julia Butterfly Hill, lived in a tree, a redwood tree, for 2 years, 2 years and 8 days, in fact, to save a stand of 1,000-year-old trees. What would you do? Could I just ask, Julia, how does the risk of embarrassment, of feeling foolish, compare with the risk to life and limb?
That's a great question, because I think a lot of times when people, especially like with me, when they saw me in People magazine and Time magazine, on television and all over, when we perceive people in the media or in the spotlight as something glamorous, as it's got to be fun, it's got to be wonderful, it's got to be an exciting way to live. But when you put your beliefs into the spotlight, you make yourself willing to go through ridicule, extreme attacks, embarrassment, numerous things that you just don't consider as an average person thinking about the perceived glamour of it. And I think that is a big stand for someone to be willing to risk their privacy and their integrity in public to make a principled stand, to say this is wrong no matter what society is telling you, no matter what scientists are telling you or the Food and Drug Administration or the government, to be willing to take on entire ways of thinking and say, no, I think that we can look back in history at many people who've changed history and done it through technology or through helping us understand creation, who were risked incredible ridicule, some of whom were even thrown out of their homes or killed for standing up for the right thing. And that's a part of the spotlight that I think sometimes we don't really consider.
What was the most wounding thing you ever heard from the ridicule faction?
I try to be an open heart, so that way things can just flow through me and not hit me deeply. I think what was most frustrating for me is when people would say things like, oh, you know, I know it was difficult, but I'm jealous of you. That would frustrate me because if it's not idyllic and it's not perfect, and if somebody's jealous, they ought to go do something. Ridicule is just my chance to try and help reach out to people and say, you know, things aren't always as they seem. We should really challenge our societal accepted norms. We should challenge our way of thinking. And I continue to try and do that even to myself.
1-800-423-8255 makes the What Would You Do for Principle connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Charles is on the line.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Julia.
Hello, Charles. Welcome.
Hello.
I have a Socratic question here. Basically, what's the difference between activism and reactivism? And three cases in point, the Miami Cubans down in Little Havana, people in South Boston protesting forced busing, and the current protests are about to take place at Antioch College over the guy who's going to give the commencement speech. What do I tell my son? What is acceptable? I mean, if he all of a sudden said, listen, I'm going to go sit on top of my computer and protest the fact of what happened to Bill Gates, is that acceptable?
Well, I think, personally, I'm about looking into intent. And I think the difference between activism and reactivism is what is our intent? If we're striking out because we're angry, or are we turning our anger into passion and commitment and coming from a place of love for life, love for the sacred, love for the priceless, irreplaceable things on our planet, including each other? I think we're talking about the difference between a principled stand and just screaming and raging.
Julia, I think the people in South Boston would say, and just to quote BJ, they would talk about an ecosystem that was being destroyed by the federal government. And that ecosystem would be their neighborhood, their right to go to, you know, a local school, whatever the issue is. I'm not trying to be belligerent here, but I'm just saying that I think that for every positive piece of activism that we see, there's another side to it that we might not find acceptable.
Well,
An ethnically segregated neighborhood of an old city is not an ecosystem. I mean, that's the first answer, Charles. I mean, lines can be drawn. You can argue that point out. And they were not protecting an ecosystem.
I do believe, though, that many social and environmental justice issues are truly connected. All of us share this planet, whether we like it or not. And all of us need clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, and a healthy, stable climate and planet to live upon. That is our commonalities. And yes, we are different. Human beings are as diverse as nature is. We need our diversity. We're not always going to agree. But what we do need to do is if something calls upon us, we must act. And yes, people aren't always going to agree. Yes, you might risk attack. You might risk your life. You might risk ridicule. But you have to follow your heart and spirit, and you have to stand up for what you feel is right. And if all of us
Where does the law come in? If Janet Reno orders alien Gonzalez returned, what about all the sort of people who are going to want to make a principled stand to keep him here?
Well, that's an issue that just gets bogged down, and we could be there forever. But I would like to quote Gandhi, because he's a brilliant man who I've learned much from since finding out about him. And he says something along the lines, if a law is unjust, it is our moral duty to take a stand against it. So we have to remember that laws are man-made. And humans, and I don't mean man as a gender thing, I'm sorry, are human made. And so therefore, because humans are fallible and are corruptible, we can be led astray, we can make mistakes, even our laws are. Let's look back at the laws we had. In this country, it used to be legal and approved of and encouraged to own another human being as private property. That was a law. And the only reason it's changed is because someone said, that law is unjust, I will not stand for it, I will take a stand against it, and people joined together.
1-800-423-8255, the What Would You Do for Principle connection. Jeffrey Wigand joins us by phone from South Carolina. He was the Vice President for Research and Development at Brown and Williamson. He's the former tobacco executive who blew the whistle on big tobacco. Did you do it for principle, Jeffrey Wigand?
Well, I think I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do, and it answered my moral compass. I mean, I would say that principle and moral compass in many cases one and the same.
It made you famous? Did it expose
painless?
You to great...
Well, I'm not so sure it made me painless.
No, famous.
Famous? I'm not so sure I'm famous. I mean, that wasn't the intent behind it.
I wonder, how did you, Julia Hill has been saying you don't count the potential blessings or even the pain involved in something like this Stan, how did you measure the risks and the danger?
Well, I don't think anybody, at least I could not, by any shake of the imagination, measured beforehand what I thought the exposure and the danger was. I did it because I believe it was the right thing to do, is in the interest of public health and safety. I thought the truth wasn't being told, and that, at least from my perspective and my belief, I had to tell the truth and wanted to tell the truth. It was an issue of deep public deception over years and years, and well as taught young children every day.
Who are your models? Julia Hill has spoken about Gandhi. I mean,
who are my models?
Yeah.
I mean, I think John F. Kennedy is one of my, what I would consider a model. My dad's, I would consider a model. I mean, I have tremendous respect for Robert Frost, the poet, and his writings. I mean, Ripley's writings. I mean, I read a lot of Paul Tseng's The Fifth Discipline. But I would say if I want to have a role model in terms of people that were in the public domain, I think Kennedy was probably a role model for many, many years for me.
Well, this is Julia.
Hi, Julia. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. I'd just like to say thank you as well. I really appreciate people who are willing to tell the truth and who are willing to take the stand, even if we don't always agree on the stand. I feel like if we're passionate and we need to do something with that passion, we need to do something. There's so many issues facing the world. When one comes to us, we must do something. And I know that to take a stand against the accepted norms, and especially against big government and big industry that are hand in hand, is a humongous task. I faced it every day while I was in the tree, and I'm continuing to face it now on the ground. So I'm glad that you've done that, and I hope it motivates others from within industry, because that's where the credibility actually ends up coming in, from someone who's been on the inside and takes what's happening behind closed doors and in files that get shredded and take it out to the public and say, you must challenge what you think. You're not always being told the truth.
Yeah, all I can say is the truth is what really saved me. I mean, I think if you believe how the industry attacked me after I went on 60 Minutes, they would lead the world to believe that I was deceitful and lying. But I must tell you that the documents that came out from the company's own cache of documents they fought to the Supreme Court to prevent from coming out have clearly vindicated and reemphasized the truth, and it clearly has made the difference, at least for me. I mean, to be vindicated when you say something and be attacked and then have it vindicated over and over again, to me is the basis by which truth stands the passage of time. I mean, many things. I mean, I'm a scientist by training, so I believe that most things change over time. And one thing that I know clearly after this is that the truth doesn't change over time. The truth stays constant, and the truth will be the truth, no matter what.
You're an honorable man, Jeffrey Wigand. Thank you for joining us on The Connection.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for doing what you did. 1-800-423-8255. The Taking a Stand for Principle Connection. Amy is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Amy.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm a little bit more in the stage of doing the calculation between the risks to myself, my career, and feeling compelled to act. A bunch of us are going to, well, a lot of people are heading to D.C. for April 16th.
Right on.
To protest the World Bank and the IMF, which are things that we don't usually think about much in day-to-day life, but lately a lot of people have been learning more about the patterns in which these organizations have operated that have actually generated poverty, which generates population spiraling out of control, and how these problems are actually created by these institutions, often which are found in our own country here. But the problem is just like seeing the response that the police had in Seattle and not knowing how people are going to respond. The police are going to respond in D.C. On the one hand, they're used to large crowds. On the other hand, I don't think they're used to large-scale direct action. So it's a very harrowing experience to think about, bodily harm or going to jail and being affected by that in terms of career, which is something we hear a lot of people do and maybe take for granted that it's no big deal.
Julia, advisor, give Amy some counsel here.
Well, Amy, first I'd like to tell you thanks for making a desire and a decision to go there. I'm going to be there too. And I know that thousands of other people are going to be there, and I'm proud of each and every one. I'm also glad that you are thinking about the risks. It is important to think about the risks. I knew when I decided to stay in the tree that there would be risks. And to be willing, when you're willing to take the step to be as informed and acknowledged as you know how, is going to help you in a situation. People prepared every way they knew for any potential violence but that would happen because of the police in Seattle, even though 99.999% of the people there were dedicated to peaceful resistance and peaceful action. But they prepared themselves so that when something happened, instead of reacting to violence in violence, they stayed as peaceful and calm as they could. There were people there to help with jail, with medics, everything. The same kind of systems are being set up in Washington, D.C. And one of the best things you can do, Amy, is form an affinity group. Find the people that you want to go with or that you want to hook up with there who have knowledge and interest and information if something happens on a physical injury, if you end up in jail, if you end up getting lost or whatever could possibly happen. Think of all the possibilities and then form an affinity group with each person in that group dedicated to having the answers to that problem. And that will help give you a sense of strength and security even no matter what happens. But we're going to stay committed to peaceful activism again, and we hope this time the police and the government can live up to the true calling of this country, including Bill Clinton, who, when the school shooting started happening, saying, we need to teach our children how to deal with some situations and differences with something other than violence. I would like to call upon him and the police and the government to do the same thing.
1-800-423-8255 makes the principal connection. Gary is on a car phone.
Hi, how you doing, Chris?
Good, Gary.
Love your show.
Thank you.
I'd like to follow on a little bit with what the veteran said earlier on, because it seems to me that conservative believers seem to get a little bit less respect. And I'll use the example of the people in the military. I'm a Marine Corps veteran. They're serving a cause because they believe in it with the same passion and the same structure as, for instance, your guest. But they seem to get less respect. And I'll use the example of the large number of people who are serving right now, sacrificing, and they're on food stamps. Serving in the military is a very difficult life. You make tremendous sacrifices. You live away from home for anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, and it's a tremendous sacrifice. Your guest, who I respect tremendously, did it for 2 years. These people are doing it for between 4 and 25 years.
And Gary, all for them, but I also wonder, you know, is there a choice of a principled sacrifice here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The values of the people who are serving, and I can only speak for Marine Corps, the values of the people, we are not doing it for pay. We're not doing it for a career. We're doing it because we believe very strongly in this country and what it stands for. It just, because it is more conservative, it seems that it doesn't, the people aren't looked upon as heroes, and they get less respect. And also because they're doing it every day. It's not necessarily grabbing headlines, but they're doing it every day, and it seems to me troubling that those people are treated less like heroes than people like your guest, who I believe is a hero for sacrificing and living a very difficult life for a period of time for something she believed in.
I don't think it's a matter of conservatives being dissed here. Gary, I certainly hope not. I mean, the Marines, a few good men and all that sort of thing, do heroic things when they have to. But they're also working for the government, being paid, joining up. I don't think it's exactly the same thing. It's honorable work. And thank you for your call. 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is on a car phone in New Hampshire.
Good morning, Chris. If possible, I'd like to bring the conversation a little bit closer to tree-hugging and Julia's experiences.
Okay.
You said something kind of politely dismissive about the small things, the millions of small gestures that people can make every day. Early on in the show, they really felt compelled to call and comment on that. If Julia had sat up in that tree and had absolutely no participation from anybody else, had not had a million little things that happened as a result of it, she'd be sitting in the middle of a tree, in the middle of a clear-cut forest like an idiot.
Okay,
what she accomplished is she caused, as do most activists, quote-unquote, they cause all the rest of us to say, well, my God, if this woman can sit in a tree for 2 years, the least I can do is carry around a mug, pick up that piece of trash, think about what I'm buying, use a little bit less water, you know, make the small sacrifices in our day. They're an inspiration to us to make the changes in our own individual lives that really make the difference in the world. And to me, that's the whole reason for doing it. That's why she's on the air.
Okay, Mark, thank you. You're listening to the connection. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Mark, I stand chastened and corrected. I didn't mean to dismiss the value of the little things, but it's the big gestures that some people hunger to make. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about heroic sacrifice on an individual basis for a principle with Julia Butterfly Hill, who lived in a redwood tree to save it for 2 years. Sean is calling from Concord, New Hampshire.
Hello.
Hello, Sean.
Hello, Christopher. Hello, Julia.
Hello, Sean.
Very good to be talking with you this morning. I'm not sure I'd call it heroic, but last May, when the United States was bombing Yugoslavia, because I had seen the effect the Tomahawk missiles had on Iraq, where friends of mine have gone and held in their arms children dying from drinking dirty water because water treatment plants were bombed, I sat down in the driveway of a Raytheon plant in Andover, Massachusetts, until I was arrested, and then ended up serving a month in jail, or the better part of a month in jail for that. And I'm planning on going back to the Raytheon plant next week on April 15th to mark the plant with blood, to reveal the blood of the victims of war that's already there in many ways, and risk arrest again because the weapons are still being made to kill people. And I found the time in jail a very profound time for reflecting and really getting to the core of my belief that all life is sacred. And I remember a moment when we were eventually moved to a minimum security jail, sitting under a very old tree out in front of the jail that had to be several hundred years old, and thinking about the fact that that tree was there before the jail was built and before the city was built, and that that life continues, that the sacredness of life is eternal, and that we really need to be ready to do what we can to stand up for the sacredness of life.
Sean, thank you. Do you want to encourage Sean? Julia?
Absolutely. Sean and everyone else out there. I especially like the fact that he brought up the honoring the sacred. And it ties in with the previous caller about the importance of the small things. Mm. When we begin to honor the sacred, we can even see the sacred in the microphones that we're talking into, because it all comes from the earth. And every little thing shapes the world we live in today and the world we're going to leave behind for others. And that's the power. The small acts are the roots. Yes, we can talk about the spotlight and the big acts, but those actions cannot happen without a solid foundation, and that solid foundation begins in recognizing our impact on the world and honoring that sacred.
1-800-423-8255 makes the principal connection. Ben is on the line.
Yes. I so appreciate what Julia has done and other people like her. I just wanted to say, though, that in a way it's sort of sad that these very few people, that we live in a culture where these very few people pop up to the surface, up to the top, and get all our acclaim, rightfully so. But I sort of feel like it, in a backhanded sort of way, indicates so much of what else is going on, which is the rest of us being so indifferent and so apathetic and not doing much of anything, thereby requiring singular people like Julia to make these heroic atlas-like.
Who says we're apathetic, Ben? I'm leaving here in a few minutes for a tree, and I may not be back.
I just feel that if more of us did little things along the way, it wouldn't require people like Julia to take such dangerous stands.
Should we say paper, not plastic, in the grocery store?
Well, no. We should bring our own bag. We should bring
our
a cloth reusable
bag.
Yes.
Ben, don't underestimate us. And let's all turn over a new leaf here. Julia Butterfly Hill, thank you enormously for the book and the example, The Legacy of Luna, Life in a Tree for 738 Days, that saved some redwoods and raised a whole lot of consciousness, and produced a wonderful book. Thank you.
Thank you. No forests were destroyed in the making of the book. And that's important.
We had help today from John Hoder, Allison Baggs, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. Our website is theconnectiononeword.org. Our website producer is Jim Norris. The Connection is produced by tree huggers like Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our Earth Mother, Senior Producer, Tree Hugger Supreme. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Don't give it up. Don't give it up. Get up, stand up. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
BRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Just ahead on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to the news, it's Editorial Roundtable Day, and the press panel will be picking away at the big dig. Also,